You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 6th to the 12th of February 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter Holly Else, news editor Simon Baker, editor-at-large Phil Beatty and writer Matthew Rice. Student loans company data show that two-for-profit colleges each now receive more mainstream public funding for their teaching than the London School of Economics does. More on that in a moment. Our cover feature this week looks at why Caltech performs so consistently well in our world university rankings. Some universities are failing to adequately address the problem of gender inequality in science, according to the MP at the head of a Commons Committee inquiry. Holly will have more on that soon. And mental illness in the academy is a very difficult issue to discuss at times. This week we have an extended interview with an academic who was treated for mental illness in the 1980s. Matthew will have more on that later on. But first, Simon, public money going to for-profit colleges is an issue we visit pretty regularly in the THE. And this week's lead news story is on that very issue.
Well, it's something that we've been keeping a close eye on for a number of years, really. Ever since the election, we've been following kind of how the expansion of private colleges has been going on. And you know, at first, when we started covering this, we were there were some suggestions that, you know, we were following this a bit too much, and that the government weren't really kind of that interested in it. Yeah. Lo and behold, a few months ago, it emerged that kind of the expansion of loan money going towards these private colleges have caused a little bit of a hole in the biz budget. So,
justified.
I'm not saying anything more than that. But anyway, what's interesting about this latest story is that we've got the latest figures on from the student loans company, which breaks down where all the money for fee loans and maintenance loans and grants, incidentally, goes in terms of each institution, and it sort of shows a huge rise basically in the amount of money that is going to the private, the new private sort of sector that's opened up, which of course they're not subject to any controls on the numbers of their students either at the moment. But some of these increases are due to kind of the fee cap for these institutions going up to £6,000, or the amount of money that they can, that students can draw on in terms of loans, going up to £6,000 in 12-13, so they expect it to go up. But there are some individual colleges that have seen huge rises from virtually nothing to several million pounds in just 1 year. So there's all sorts of questions about kind of whether this has been checked and what sort of courses they're on, and you know, whether this it's kind of justified, whether there's kind of proper quality assurance that's going on at the same time of that sector. You know, every college is different, to be honest. It'd be fair to say that some private colleges, you know, are absolutely getting, you know, they signed up the QAA and they have quality assurance, all those kind of things. But it's a very diverse sector, so you know, possibly can't say that for every college. And some have had their funding suspended recently because of you know, worries about the expansion of loan fees, loans going to those.
Yeah, and I mentioned in my introduction there's two that are now sort of getting more for teaching than LSE, which I guess
that was our headline there, because if you look at there's two colleges there. GSM London, or Greenwich School of Management, which had already been quite a draw on the fee loans, actually, and I think it's probably increase has got a lot to do with that fee cap increase I mentioned before. The other college being St Patrick's, which saw total SLC funding go up to £42 million in 2012-13. Those two together actually had each more fee loans in that year than LSE and SOAS. And I mean, LSE and SOAS are small in terms of undergraduates and the fee loans that they're taking. I mean, LSE has a lot of international students. SOAS is a small institution compared with some of the bigger ones, but still, you know, illustrates how the sector's growing.
Yeah, no, it's an issue we've had on the podcast before. We said we would follow it as it developed, and on page 6 and 7, this week, John Morgan, who isn't with us, does just that in the article we've just discussed. But the cover article this week, the cover feature, I should say, Phil, you travelled a lot in your role as our rankings editor and editor at large of the magazine. You've been over to Caltech in California to find out, you know, how it became the world's number one university.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a pretty serious burden being editor at large and having to travel so much, but I thought it was very important to take myself to Los Angeles.
Of course.
Spend some time in California in December when they were complaining how cold it was and I was marvelling at how warm it was. But no, the California Institute of Technology has been our number one in the world rankings for the last 3 years. And obviously, I've spent a lot of time looking at the data, and the data is solid. It's research impact scores, it's international outlook scores, its reputation is fantastic. But we thought it was really important to go in there and spend a lot of time in there, immerse ourselves in the culture and speak to the faculty and really find out exactly what's so special about the place. And it was really quite an inspiring story. I spoke to some of the world's leading scientists in their fields and spoke to them at length about what it is about the place that's so good. And a few things came out which I think were really refreshing. A lot of places around the world are trying to copy Caltech, ape Caltech, and certainly in East Asia and the Middle East, there's a sense of it being a role model. But the thing that was very refreshing, actually, is the sense of real freedom they have. This real sense that actually chasing metrics, chasing publication outputs, which obviously people do to try and rise up rankings, isn't what they're about. They have this confidence to allow people wonderful freedom. Of course, they're very, very rich with great philanthropic benefits, and they're also very, very small. But being small allows them to hire extremely carefully, give people great freedom, you know, work really hard to find the right people, but then really let them loose on fundamental discovery when they're there. It means the management system is extremely flat, so there's hardly much any bureaucracy. They can get things done. It was a really inspirational place, actually.
Mm-hmm. We can hear a little, actually, from one of those faculty members that you speak of. This is Fiona Harrison, who's Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Caltech, speaking to you on your trip.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that is unique to the environment is it's small. So that can be a disadvantage, but in Caltech's case, it's a real advantage because, you know, I know most of the other faculty, and over my time here have collaborated with people from aeronautical engineering, from applied physics, from, you know, different disciplines, and you run into them at the coffee shop and sort of start a conversation, and it turns out you're both thinking about some similar technology, perhaps one person for a, you know, deformable ground-based mirror and me for something that I want to do in space. And so it's this cross-fertilization and lack of, it's not even lack of barriers to interdisciplinary research. It's sort of the natural, it's just natural to the culture, to the fabric of the place.
So Professor Hamilton there talking about the culture at Caltech, is that something that you sort of picked up on while you were there?
Yeah, I thought what was wonderful from Fiona Harrison's position is that she's got equipment on a NASA mission. She's discovering black holes. She's an extremely exciting scientist. But she talked about how, you know, the serendipitous elements of work that, you know, it's a cliche, but they literally bump into each other at the coffee shop and forge new alliances. She's talking about the fact that they almost have a cultural sense that they should be not following anyone else's fields, they should be creating new fields. And there's something very special about it being so small and intimate. Everybody knows each other, and I think that's important. But she spoke very encouragingly well about the fact that people take risks on them. When she was a young early career researcher, she wasn't just told to churn out the papers to get the grants in. You know, they're freed from responsibilities for chasing grants. They're given really good funding when they first arrive, right up to the tenure process. So I think it's that sense of being confident enough to take risks and to not push their young people into the publish or perish culture, which is kind of a really important message, because I think the role model that Caltech provides potentially does push people into the chasing publications and chasing rankings metrics, but actually it's being confident enough to be free and liberated from rankings metrics that actually helps them be successful in the rankings.
Let's not give too much away. You can find that in this week's magazine. Our rankings publication is always very popular. I'm sure this one will be too. Now, today, the Common Science and Technology Committee publishes its Women in Scientific Careers report. Holly, you've been speaking to its author, and he had some, should I say, fairly stern words for universities.
Yes, he did. So this report looked at why women are not progressing in scientific careers. I mean, at the moment, just 17% of all professors working in science, technology, engineering and maths are women. And so the report wanted to sort of understand exactly why this was happening. And I spoke to Andrew Miller, who is the chair of the committee. And he basically said that perhaps some universities weren't taking this seriously enough. I mean, it wasn't high enough up their agenda. I mean, he did stress that there was some good work out there, and one of those things he mentioned was the Athena Swan Awards, which basically gives university departments a gold, silver or bronze award based on their diversity and equality issues. Mm. So he said a lot more can be done, really, and he hoped that would happen. I mean, one of the big areas where the report identified there could be problems for women is in this period after completing a PhD, where scientists typically become a postdoctoral researcher for a couple of years, where they work in several different institutions, perhaps around the world, even in different countries, before they become sort of into a more permanent role. And the committee found that these fixed-term positions can actually be quite disruptive for a researcher's life outside of academia, because it typically happens between the ages of 25 and 35, which is the same time most people sort of settle down, get a mortgage and start a family, which, of course, if you're moving around and don't have a permanent contract, can be quite difficult.
Mm-hmm. No, it's certainly one of the issues that came out of our Best University Workplace survey as well, which we published last week, and something we're going to explore further. Many comments about, you know, how women can't get the positions, don't get the recognition that they deserve, and this report out today only sort of backs up some of that. Read the full report from Holly on page 6 this week. Now, finally, mental illness is often considered a taboo subject. Matthew, you've been speaking to someone who maybe knows a bit more about it than most.
Yes, well, this is historian Barbara Taylor, who, she told me, basically lost about 10 years of her life to mental illness. She was in psychotherapy altogether for over 20 years, and about 6 months, I think, in the late 80s, she was on and off in Free and Barnet Asylum. So, and then she came out, it was the time of care in the community, and she was involved in various sort of halfway houses and adult adoption schemes and so on. But she was really not functioning, well, as an adult, and certainly not as a professional academic for, mm-hmm. for 10 years.
And what's her role at the moment? What's her position now?
She's a professor of history at Queen Mary University of London. And her book is a memoir, in many ways very harrowing and upsetting. But she also kind of has a beady historian's eye, looking at her own experience as part of a wider scene, and you know, whether what sense these asylums were abusive institutions or very depressing institutions, or whether they were what some people needed in particular crises in their lives, and so on, with psychotherapy and halfway houses and hostels, and whether these facilities are available now. And the question she really asks is, you know, if she'd had a similar breakdown now, or a young woman had had a similar breakdown now, whether they would have got the support she got and whether they would have survived, as she has now gone on to survive and become a very distinguished historian. So it's quite painful, the personal detail, but it's also quite sobering about whether the support is still there that she did manage to access.
Interesting stuff. Yes, do check that out on page 42 this week. We have a second podcast out this week as well. My interview with Dr. Fahim Shalabi, who's Assistant Deputy Minister for HE in the Palestinian National Authority, and Professor Karim Tahoub, an academic at the Palestine Polytechnic University, is published as a second podcast that you'll find in the same place as you found this one. But until next week, that's the end of this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.